Monster Man, episode 270, Worms. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are completing our journey through the W section of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. But before we do that, it's time to thank some new patrons. Yes, these are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's backers, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take a look at the Deities and Demigods supplement and it using religion and mythology in your fantasy role-playing games. So thank you very much, Jake Bickford and Gerald Johnson. Your support really means a lot to me. All right, the end of this section consists of two different kinds of worm. The first is the tenebrous worm. Now, the tenebrous worm is the larval form of the gloom wing, which we talked about earlier. They're native to the plane of shadows, and they're basically big, dangerous caterpillars. They have a wide range of horrible attack. They remind me a little bit of the stegocentipede in the sense of being a monster that has a different kind of combat areas. That is to say, the character standing in different positions relative to it will have slightly different combat experiences. And it also has this subsystem for being stuck by its bristles. So if you hit it with a bare-handed attack, you know, a punch or a claw or whatever, or an inflict wounds spell, then you're likely to get stuck by the bristles around its, like, head and neck. But if you attack it with a weapon, then you get a chance to protect yourself from the bristles based on how much armor you're wearing. Like a lot of monsters in the first Monster Manual, they also have valuable parts. Their mandibles are kind of a mother-of-pearl type of substance that you can, you know, make into jewelry or the backs of hairbrushes or whatever, I don't know. This is really interesting to me because this is something that we tended to see relatively early on with monsters like the Beaver Comma Giant, this idea of, you know, player characters hunting them for their pelts, right? The player characters are almost like, you know, they're voyageurs or whatever, they're going off into the unknown to get beaver pelts and start the Seven Years' War, and while they're there, they're getting into scrapes and so forth. The idea that the player characters are just kind of outdoorsy types. And then, you know, maybe it's just me, but it feels like that really fell off in the Feedfolio and Monster Manual 2. So here we see a very different version of the same idea, and it fits kind of weirdly. So I feel like the Beaver Comma Giant is a very sort of mundane monster, and hunting for beaver pelts is a very kind of mundane activity. The grounded low-levelness of the activity seems to correlate well with the grounded low-levelness of the monster. So going to the Plane of Shadow to hunt for tenebrous worm mandibles feels like a kind of a short-sighted thing to do once you have the ability to go to other planes, right? Or we're going to go to other planes not to fulfill a sacred quest or, you know, expand our knowledge of the infinite other dimensions, but to make a quick buck. I feel like once you are able to do that, there are probably easier ways to make money. But on the other hand, maybe it's a waste not, want not type of situation. Anyway, the tenebrous worm does introduce one interesting point, which I'm actually going to address in the next section about the tunnel worm. So the tunnel worm is kind of a giant centipede, and what it does is that imagine that you're going down a kind of dungeon corridor-y sort of tunnel, that along the sides of the tunnel will be the nests of the tunnel worm, and it'll emerge from its nest, grab someone, and retreat back into its nest to devour them, right? So it's the popping out of the hole and then going back into the hole with its prey. It reminds me a little bit of the bit where they're going through the underground area in Big Trouble in Little China, and like a big creepy monster comes out of a hole, grabs one of the goodies, and retreats into the hole with him, and then Egg Shen throws a smoke bomb at it, and he goes, "It will come out no more." And Jack Burton very understandably goes, "What, Egg? What will come out no more?" So that would be the tunnel worm, I suppose. It will come out no more. And once again, the tunnel worm has kind of got a subsystem for how long it takes to chew through your armor, right? There's a system based on, like, what level of armor you're wearing that determines how long it takes the tunnel worm to, like, get your armor off and then begin the process of devouring you. Presumably, meanwhile, you're companions are, you know, having at the walls of the burrow with picks and shovels or stone-shaped spells or whatever so that they can rescue you. There are quite a lot of monsters in this book that have that, like, encounter structure where someone gets grabbed and then the others have to rescue them. Yeah, I can see how that definitely generates interesting tension. It might be a little dull to be the player who had to be rescued, or maybe not dull, because you would have the question of whether you were going to live or die, so I suppose that's not dull, but you wouldn't really get to do anything. Maybe this is, we're still in that world where many players have multiple characters within the party, so you still get to do something even while one of your characters is being eaten up by a tunnel worm. This is the, I mean, I've spoken about this before, but this is an example, together with the poisonous bristle subsystem in the Tenebris Worm, this forms an example of something that's pretty typical of monsters of this era, which is that they tend to have often relatively complicated subsystems contained within the monster. And what that means is that you as the DM have everything that you need for the encounter, or at least many of the things that you need for the encounter, in the entry in front of you. If you've ever tried to run a high-level 5th edition encounter, you'll know that a lot of the time, it's really a two-booker because you're going to have to look up what it is that this thing does. So the monster entry will tell you that the target is blinded, and you got to go back and look up in the player's handbook what it means to be blinded or on your DM screen. Or a lot of creatures will have abilities that are essentially spells. Mind you, that's true in this edition as well. But there's a lot of monsters in 1st edition that essentially contain little mini-rules that dictate the rules content of the encounter. That has advantages and disadvantages. From a play perspective, you can certainly see how it's more convenient. Where it doesn't work is from the perspective of, like, the game designer or the person who wants the rules to, like, harmonize and make sense. Because what happens is that all of these rules cover different situations, but they're not all the same. Like, consider all the many different sets of rules for what happens if a monster swallows you alive. So which is easier, to create unique swallowing rules for every monster you might ever run into, or to create a single set of rules for people being swallowed alive and hope that DMs and players remember it in the moment? I've written here the problems of imperfect mastery. And I'm not 100% sure what that means, but I think it's to do with the idea that, you know, later editions of D&D were predicated on this idea of system mastery. And I get what they were trying to achieve with that, but it is not something that I myself ever accomplished. It's just an interesting example of the differing design philosophies, or the products of the differing design circumstances that developed during early editions of the game. So it seems, and I am no expert on the history of the way these rules developed, but it seems as if what we generally get is a relatively simple set of core rules, and then a very large number of spot rules, and then some of those rules wind up being incorporated back into the core rules, or rules emerging from situations get incorporated back into the core rules, until what we have now is a very detailed body of core rules and a very small number of spot rules. And from a purely pick-up-and-play perspective, I'm not convinced that the spot rules aren't actually simpler, even though they're less coherent, they're less consistent, because they don't need to be consistent with each other, because you're not using them all. You're only using some of them. So the fact that they don't line up with rules printed somewhere else doesn't really make a difference, because the odds that you're using both of those things, and that anybody will notice or care, are not high. All right, that is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be barreling down the home stretch as we enter the X section of Monster Manual 2, here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.